From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we remember the father of the new tango, Astor Piazzolla. His dark music, a hybrid of tango, rock, and classical music, was so controversial in his native Argentina, he faced death threats. Piazzolla died of a stroke in 1992. A new CD featuring music he recorded in 1989 has just been released. We'll hear some of it and listen back to a 1988 interview. Also an interview with composer Charles Strauss. His hit Broadway musicals include Bye Bye Birdie, Applause, and Annie. There's a new review of his songs in New York this month. David Bianculli reviews Muppets Tonight, the new TV series by Brian Henson, the son of Jim Henson, the creator of the Muppets. And John Powers reviews Fargo, the new film by the Coen brothers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The White House says that President Clinton expects the participants in next week's Mideast summit meeting to reaffirm the Arab-Israeli peace process and combat terrorism. The president will co-host the summit with Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak at an Egyptian resort on the Red Sea. Russian President Boris Yeltsin has been invited, along with Israeli Prime Minister Shimon Peres, Palestinian President Yasser Arafat, and King Hussein of Jordan. White House spokesman Mike McCurry said President Clinton will go to Jerusalem after the one-day summit for an overnight visit. Senate Minority Leader Tom Daschle says he fears there will soon be another federal government shutdown as budget talks heat up again between Congress and the White House. UPI's Carol Van Dam reports.
Daschle says a third partial government shutdown is more likely now than at any time since the last one, a record 21-day outage that ended in early January.
In spite of all of the protestations about not wanting to do so, I believe the government is likely to shut down unless the Republicans live up to their promise. I think that's unfortunate.
Republicans took most of the blame from voters for the previous two shutdowns. Daschle says a new GOP-backed stopgap bill to prevent a shutdown next week still cuts far too deeply into environmental and education programs. Carol Van Dam, Capitol Hill.
A Turkish Cypriot passenger jet with at least 100 people on board has been hijacked. An airline official said the Boeing 727 was hijacked on a flight from Cyprus to Istanbul. It has now landed in Sofia, Bulgaria. The airline said the passengers include Russians, Iranians, Bulgarians, and Turks. The identity of the hijackers wasn't immediately known. The nation's unemployment rate fell to 5.5% last month, with more than 700,000 jobs created. That's the largest monthly increase in 10 years. Analyst Robert Dederich calls this a very strong report.
The wage number remained well-behaved, so that inflation is not a concern. We had the best of both worlds. Whatever adjective you can think of that's on the strong side, that's the one to use to describe this report, and more importantly, to describe the average of the last two reports. Very solid growth.
The 30-year Treasury bond plummeted nearly 3 points on the news, pushing its yield up to 6.67%. NASA decided to leave the space shuttle Columbia in orbit for an extra day today after bad weather in Florida delayed a landing there for 24 hours. NASA managers decided not to land the shuttle at the backup site in California because of the extra expense of flying it back to Florida. Columbia is staying aloft despite a problem with one of the computer systems that controls its landing devices. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrials are down 142 points at 5,499. This is NPR. Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole emerged from yesterday's primary victory in New York, calling himself the presumptive nominee of the Republican Party. He accused Steve Forbes and Pat Buchanan of hurting the party in his own chances of beating President Clinton in November. Dole told reporters that Forbes has money and Buchanan has rhetoric, and conceded that neither appeared likely to give up soon. Yesterday, Dole collected all 93 delegates at stake in New York, even though Forbes spent nearly $2 million on the race. Michigan businessman Maurice Taylor gave up his run for the Republican presidential nomination today. Taylor says he's placing his support behind Senator Bob Dole. Bjorn Malmquist of member station WDET reports from Detroit.
Taylor appeared at a press conference in Metro Detroit this morning where he announced his plans to endorse frontrunner Bob Dole. Taylor says Dole has by now secured the nomination. At the press conference, he urged Pat Buchanan and Steve Forbes to drop out of the race as well. Despite spending more than $6 million out of his own pocket, the Taylor campaign barely made a ripple in the Republican race for the presidential nomination. Taylor earned few votes and hadn't won any delegates to the Republican National Convention. Taylor, who is from Michigan, runs a tire company in Illinois. He based his campaign on the idea that it would take a businessman to run the country more efficiently. For National Public Radio, this is Bjorn Mumquist in Detroit.
The UN War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague has issued an international arrest warrant for Croatian Serb leader Milan Martic. Martic was indicted for war crimes for ordering the bombing of civilians in Zagreb in 1995. Martic is the former president of the so-called Republic of Serbian Krajina, which was seized by rebel Croatian Serbs after Croatia declared its independence from the Yugoslav Federation. Martic now lives in the Serbian-controlled city of Banja Luka in Bosnia. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A posthumous recording has just been released by the father of the new tango, Astor Piazzolla. He was an Argentinian composer who was at the forefront of the tango revival in America. His music was featured in the Broadway hit Tango Argentina, but he was in no way a revivalist. His music, which was dubbed New Tango, was a hybrid of traditional tango, classical music, jazz, and rock. When Piazzolla started performing his new tangos in the mid-50s, tango traditionalists in his country acted as if he'd committed treason. They verbally and physically attacked him. Piazzolla died in July of 1992 after a stroke. He was 71. He would have celebrated his 75th birthday this month. We're going to remember him today with a 1988 interview. First, let's hear music from the new CD, 57 Minutos con la Realidad, featuring sessions he recorded in 1989. Piazzolla is featured on bandoneon. It's an accordion-like instrument, but instead of a keyboard on one side, there are buttons on both sides. Early in Astor Piazzolla's career, he composed for the Buenos Aires Philharmonic Orchestra and performed with traditional tango groups. When I spoke with him in 1988, he told me that he first performed his new tangos in 1954. I asked him about the state of the traditional tango in Argentina at that time.
It was going out. I mean, there was a very big invasion of Elvis Presley and rock music and boleros from Mexico. Bill Haley was invading also Argentina with his music, and the young Argentinians, 15, 16, the teenagers of my country, started listening to this more exciting music and not that boring tango that they have been playing during 50 or 60 years in Argentina. So the young people wanted more electricity in their veins, and they chose American music. And then after they chose English music, and today that's how the people are divided in my country, with English and American music, and the old people of 50 years up like tango. They still like the old-fashioned tango. But the new tango, the one I play, fortunately, It's the people of rock and roll who love my music, the people who like modern jazz, or the people who like to listen to Bela Bartok or Stravinsky. That's the people who follow my music.
Now, you got the nickname the Assassin of the Tango when you started playing the new tango. Were there actually threats against you by people who were very upset with you for having taken the traditional tango and made something else of it?
Yes, yes. The telephones, menaces, and my family and me, and they used to call me on the phone and say they would wait for me in the streets and they would give me a beating. Why? Just because I changed the tango. But I didn't change the tango. What I changed is the way of playing and the way of writing. I mean, I gave it a new dimension, harmonically speaking, and with rhythmically speaking, and the way I arranged it. I mean, nobody was interested in changing tango because they didn't have the condition to do it.
So you had people who were literally calling you up and threatening on the telephone, trying to pick fights with you because of your new tango music. Why do you think that your music caused such a violent reaction? I mean, people like music, they dislike music, but they don't necessarily want to try to kill the composer of the music they dislike.
Number one, the people couldn't dance with my music. The dancers of tango hated me. They detested Astor Piazzolla. You can't dance with Astor Piazzolla. The singers of Argentina detested me. They hated my music because it wasn't singing music. Nobody sang my music. So I was playing instrumental music during 5 or 6 years, and really it was a flop. I had to leave Argentina, and it was in 1958 that I had to abandon this idea of being a musician in my own country. I came to another. This was the second time. I was living in 1924 in New York till 1937. Nearly 14 years when I was a boy. Then I came back in 1958, and it's very strange. We went together with Lalo Schifrin. We came to New York, and Lalo Schifrin went to the sky, and I went to hell directly because nobody loved my music, nobody understood my music, and nobody wanted me to record. Even if I made one stupid record, I call it stupid because it was good for nothing. When you do what the other people want, I think it always is stupid.
I want to talk about growing up in New York. It's really ironic in a way that the person who furthered the tradition of the Argentinian tango actually spent most of his childhood growing up in New York City. Your parents moved with you when you were 3 to New York. Why did they want to leave Argentina?
Well, my father, he was a dreamer like his father. My grandfather was a dreamer. He was a sailor. He sailed from Italy, from the north of Italy, in the Adriatic, the city of Trani. They came to Mar del Plata, where we live 400 kilometers south of Buenos Aires. And that's where nearly all Italian families live in Argentina, in this port of Mar del Plata. So my grandfather was a dreamer and a sailor. My father was a dreamer, and I continue to be a dreamer also. And that's why we came to New York. My father, my mother, and I am the only son in the family. And the 3 of us came to New York in 1923. And nearly 14 years, I went to school here. I know more the Star Spangled Banner than my my own hymn from Argentina.
But what about tangos? Did you hear many tangos when you were growing up?
Well, I was born playing John Sebastian Bach on the bandoneon because it sounds more like an organ. As the instrument, my teacher, I had a very important piano concert player. His name was Bela Wilda. He was Hungarian, and he taught me to play all classical music and the bandoneon. I never played a tango when I was small.
Did you hate tango like a lot of children growing up hate their parents' music?
Well, I hated to do what my father wanted, but my father suddenly started loving John Sebastian Bach, and he was next to me. He was my friend. He was the one who insisted that I should play classical music. He loved more that his son would be a classical musician than a popular tango musician.
Did you start playing tangos at all when you were in New York?
I started in 1934, yes, with Carlos Gardel. He was a very important singer from Argentina. He came to New York he made 3 films in New York and Long Island with John Reinhardt as a director. And I played the music in the tango music in the film while he was singing. And that's how I started my career as a tango musician.
That was just a couple of years after that that you moved back to Argentina, right?
In 1937, before the war, my father got scared and we went all back to Argentina. And I started my musical career at, when I was 18 years old, between 17 and 18 years old in the city of Buenos Aires. I left Mar del Plata and I started with the best orchestras. That's when I received my first crash as a tango musician. I started all of a sudden to love tango, and all the education, the classical education I had. Imagine, I used to play Rhapsody in Blue of Gershwin on the bandoneon. I used to play Sophisticated Lady of Ellington, and the people used to look at me as if I was a Martian. I mean, you can never find a bandoneon player in Argentina. I don't know if today if someone exists who could play the Rhapsody in Blue. Or
you also studied piano, right?
Yes, I studied piano and composition. I studied everything in music. But the most tremendous of all is tango world. I mean, the tango people are people that are born and live and die only for tango. They are not interested in other manifestations of music or painting or theater. And my teacher, my musical teacher in Buenos Aires, who was Alberto Ginastera, he always told me that it's not only music you must learn in this world. You have to know whom are the painters, the poets, all the writers, and you must go to the theater and see plays. And that's how I was... I grew like that.
We're featuring a 1988 interview with Astor Piazzolla. He died in 1992 at the age of 71 after a stroke. A new CD has just been released featuring music he recorded in 1989. We'll return to our interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our 1988 interview with the late Astor Piazzolla, the Argentinian composer and bandoneon player who was known as the father of the new tango. So you studied with Ginastera, and you also went to Paris to study with Nadia Boulanger. And many great composers have wonderful stories about how Boulanger changed their lives and changed their music. You have a story like that, too.
When I arrived to Paris in 1954 with all my music, I thought I was a genius because I wrote 20 symphonies and 20 sonatas and so many chamber music pieces. And all of a sudden, Nadia Boulanger, in one afternoon in 3 or 4 hours, looks all over my music and says, "This is good for nothing. Throw it away because I can't find Astor Piazzolla." And she wanted to know which is my real profession as a musician. I was very ashamed to tell her that I played in a nightclub, and those moments I was playing in a cabaret, not a nightclub. It's too refined to say a nightclub. It was a cabaret in Buenos Aires. I played there and I studied at the same time. And she says, "You play tango? Oh, that's beautiful. I love tango." And now she's going to ask me if I play piano or what I play. And I have to tell her I play bandoneon. It's worse. So I told her, "Look, I don't play piano. I'm not a pianist. I'm a very bad pianist. I play bandoneon." "Oh, bandoneon, that's beautiful. I love that instrument. I can hear that in Kurt Weill's music, and I can hear that also in Boris Blacher, and all famous German composers use the bandoneon in symphonic orchestras." So she gave me this strength to believe in myself. She was like my second mother. She spoke to me like my mother never spoke to me. She taught me to believe in myself, and since that moment I started believing in myself and in tango music also, above all.
So you kind of really needed her permission to write in your own voice.
Yes, I needed her permission. She was the only one. I needed somebody that was superior, and she was really superior to everybody. And she loved my music, she loved my tango music. She heard it and she said, "This is Astor Piazzolla. Please don't ever leave it."
You know, tango is, at least to us Americans, associated with horror houses and clubs and things like that. Most, I don't know so what about clubs, but...
You forgot Hernando's Hideaway.
And, right, sure. That's right. But did you go through a period like that when you were in Argentina before you started composing the new tangos and giving recitals as opposed to playing for dancers? Well, did you go through a period of playing in whorehouses at all?
Well, yes, I played. I'm a normal man. I mean, I played in whorehouses since I was 18. I played when I was 45. I played, that was the last one, when I, in 1963 or 64. But one day, only 2 days, I mean, I wasn't employed as a musician to play in whorehouses or bordels. I just played those 2 days, and it was something I really didn't know, but I had much fun because I was considered as a very exponent of a cultural music in Argentina, and all of a sudden I found myself playing in a whorehouse. So that was very funny for me.
You know, the tango is also a dance associated with this real macho ethic. Is that true? I mean, you've actually played tangos. You're not looking at it at a distance. Is it really associated with a very macho style?
Yes, it's a way of making love. That's I found out of this action when I was only 18 or 19 years old. I was seeing the people dancing when I was playing not with my orchestra, with other orchestras I used to play with. And I used to see how they were so compenetrated of what they were dancing. They danced with their eyes closed as if they were dreaming. And it was the man and the woman at the same time. And at the same time, they made love. And it was so strange. I was so young, and I was looking at this as discovering something I never saw in my life.
Are there is there a mystique about the sexual prowess of tango musicians?
Well, I don't know. It could be, but I discovered that something I never knew, that my music was sensual music. It was sexual. I never intended to do sensual music. But my only intention was to write the music I feel, that I think it's very religious, it's very melancholic, it's sad, it could be very sophisticated, it could be very aggressive, it's very revolutionary. I mean, It's contemporary popular music, and it has a little of everything. The only thing that my music doesn't have is the word happy. There's no happiness.
That's an interesting point. Why isn't there?
Because I think the happiness, we, the musicians, have happiness when we play it. We love to play that way. We love to be melancholic. We love to be religious. And that's the way we get happy, because that's the lesson I learned, that the only thing that's important on a stage is to see a musician happy. If you're not happy, that means you don't like what you're playing.
Well, I want to play an excerpt from the album that introduced you to many Americans a couple of years ago. The album is called Zero Hour, and it's on the American Clave record. And this is another composition of yours. This is called Concerto for a Quintet. And let's listen. Thank you. Music from Astor Piazzolla's album Zero Hour, which was released a couple of years ago on the American Clave record. And Astor Piazzolla is an Argentinian composer, the founder of the New Tango. That's a wonderful piece. Let me ask you, are there any American real schlocky interpretations of tangos that you get a real kick out of now?
Well, I think that not only Americans, I think the fault is of the Europeans, the Germans and the French and the Italians, who had an idea, of what really tango was. And that spread, that came to our United States. And when Louis Armstrong used to play I Get Ideas, and when other musicians played Hernando's Hideaway, that was really a kick in the liver when I heard Hernando's Hideaway. That was terrible. And the Argentines were furious because that was making fun of what really was our tango was. I mean, our tango is something completely different. I insist, when somebody really knows how to dance, and when they dance the tango profoundly as they feel it, you can see that it's like making love. I mean, it's as if nobody was looking at them, and it's something you'd really love. That's why they dance that way.
So when you hear Hernando's Hideaway now, do you laugh or do you get angry?
I get sick. I get sick yet.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, it's been very nice. Thank you.
Astor Piazzolla recorded in 1988. He died in 1992 at the age of 71. A new CD featuring music he recorded in 1989 has just been released, called 57 Minutos con Realidad, on the record label Intuition. Here's more music from the CD. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, an interview with composer Charles Strauss. His Broadway musicals include Bye Bye Birdie, Applause, and Annie. Also, TV critic David Bianculli reviews Muppets Tonight, and John Powers reviews the Coen brothers' new film, Fargo.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. 20 years ago, Jim Henson tried to sell the networks on a primetime family variety series called The Muppet Show. They passed. So Henson made the show for syndication, where it became a worldwide hit. Tonight, Henson's son Brian revives the idea with a new series called Muppets Tonight, and this time it's on ABC. TV critic Deva Bianculli has this review.
I loved everything about the old Muppet Show. I loved the way Kermit the Frog, as the host, barely got through each show because of all the backstage nonsense. I loved the silly musical production numbers and film parodies. I loved the great guest stars and the good sight gags and the really bad puns. And I loved Statler and Waldorf, the old grumps who criticized each stage show from their seats in the balcony. Well, on Muppets Tonight, which starts tonight on ABC, things are a little different. Instead of running a Muppet theater, Kermit is running a Muppet TV station. Although there's just as much confusion as before, as you can tell from the production meeting that opens the program.
Okay. All right, settle down, everybody. Settle down. I'd like to welcome everyone to our new Muppet Television Studios.
Yeah.
And here's Gonzo the Great to tell us about some of our new programs. Take it away, Gonzo. Yeah,
thank you very much, Kermit. Let's see here. On Monday, we have Murphy Prawn.
That's my favorite.
And the single duck in the city with his apartment full of friends.
I like that one, too.
And for this evening show right now, we have TBA, followed by the X-Fly.
Excuse me, Gonzo, but TBA means to be announced, which means we don't have a show for tonight.
What? No show? Oh, man, that's terrible!
That hole in the schedule is filled by Muppets Tonight, with a new Muppet called Clifford as the host, and with Miss Piggy as the special guest star who comes in to save the day. That is, until an even more special guest star arrives, Michelle Pfeiffer. When those two meet backstage, it's not pretty, but it is funny.
Miss Piggy! Miss Piggy!
Yes?
I just wanted to say I'm a big fan of yours.
Of course you are, dear. Where would you like me to sign?
Oh, no, I'm not here for your autograph.
Look, if this is about the hair extensions, I am not responsible for what they did to your hair or your pots.
No, I'm Michelle Pfeiffer.
Oh! Of course! Barney Pfeiffer's wife.
My love for the old Muppet Show could have worked against this new one, because Muppets Tonight has to be pretty terrific to measure up. The good news is, it's just as much fun as the old version, and there's enough stuff crammed in here for the whole family to enjoy, even if your whole family consists of just one adult. The best bit in tonight's premiere, and the one that proves the Muppets haven't lost a step in 20 years, is the show's devastating parody of Baywatch. On Muppets Tonight, it's an all-pig version called Bay of Pigs Watch, starring Miss Piggy. But Miss Piggy is upstaged by a shapely new lifeguard who bounces around in an overstuffed bikini. That new Piggy's name? Spamela Hamderson. Puns don't get any better or any worse than that. With Muppets Tonight on TV, I'm in hog heaven.
If you're a human being, take a break from the race. Take a load off your feet, pop the look off your face. Got a lot to do, and we do it for you. Everybody take your place.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Things are jumping for composer Charles Strauss, whose Broadway musicals include Bye Bye Birdie, Golden Boy, Applause, and Annie. Bye Bye Birdie was recently adapted for TV, featuring Jason Alexander. Strauss's new musical, Palm Beach, is scheduled for Broadway next season. Applause is about to be sent out on a pre-Broadway national tour. And there's a new Charles Strauss review at the New York Cabaret Rainbow and Stars, featuring Linda Lavin. On this archive edition, we have a 1994 interview with Charles Strauss. Let's start with his song Tomorrow from Annie. The lyrics are by Martin Charnin.
The sun'll come out tomorrow. Bet your bottom dollar that tomorrow there'll be sun. just thinking about tomorrow. Clears away the cobwebs and the sorrow till there's none. When I'm stuck with a day that's gray and lonely, I just stick out my chin and grin and say, oh, the sun will come out tomorrow, so you gotta hang on till tomorrow. Come what may, tomorrow, tomorrow, I love you. Tomorrow, you're always a day away.
When you wrote the songs for Annie and now for Annie Warbucks, did you have to write in a range that you were confident a kid could sing?
Well, that's really an interesting question, because yes and no. The yes is a part of my musical background. I know what kids' ranges and sopranos and tenors are. The no part is that I wanted to squeeze a little bit more out of them, because the emotional part of the music is when kids sing high, they scream. You know, I did it in Bye Bye Birdie, and in Bye Bye Birdie, they sang notes in the telephone hour that they didn't think they could sing. And actually, I had learned a lot of that. I used to work for Frank Lesser. I was his assistant for 2 years. And I remember when Frank was testing people for range, he would often have them sing do 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 do
from Bushel and a Peck.
From Bushel and a Peck. And because it was, he would put it in a key with the pianist that it would be out of their range. They had to go do 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 do. But because they were making fun, they could or could not hit it. Had you said sing that note legitimately in a song like, I don't know, If I Loved You or something, they would have said they can't reach it. But when they were playing these characters, they could. So I devised, it's not my own invention, but or maybe it is, I don't know. These kids would come in, and I would just have them sing Happy Birthday. Once they passed the other thing, I would have them sing a song that they didn't have to worry about anything. And so they would, Happy Birthday, Happy Birthday. See, and very often they found that they could reach notes which on their resumes they couldn't reach at all, and that was the sound I wanted. So I did write for that, and particularly in a song like Hard Knock Life and in Tomorrow, the song Tomorrow. And what happened was that at the very beginning, during our auditions, nobody could sing these songs. Today, every girl in the world sings them, which is, it's a wonderful, actually, tribute to the psychology of and, you know, and any popularity the songs have.
Let me move to the first show that you did that was a real hit, one of the Broadway classics, and that's Bye Bye Birdie. Now, I had to tell you, I was listening to the album again last night, and I hadn't heard the score in a long time, and I was just shocked to realize that I remembered words to songs when I'd completely forgotten the song existed, like Normal American Boy. I mean, I haven't thought about that song in years, and I realized, God, I know all the words to this. And I bet so many people have that reaction when they hear songs from Bye Bye Birdie.
Yes, fortunately they do. It's a very, very much performed show. At the time, Lee Adams and Mike Stewart and I wrote it. We wrote it because it was offered us, you might say. We would have written, I guess, almost any show that was offered us. It actually wasn't even in that shape. It was just to be a show about teenagers. But had we realized that it would have that kind of commercial clout, that is, that high schools and camps and prisons, I don't know, everybody does it. It's incredible. And it keeps picking up in performances. I think we would have said, oh, let's do that show. But at the time, it was just, it was actually even a little strange. It was a bit of an embarrassment in a funny way to me and to Mike, because, well, to me particularly, because I had I'd been in serious music all my life. I'd studied classical music. I was embarking on a serious music career, and that this would be the first opportunity that I'd have for a major public hearing. And then that we had this silly name, Bye Bye Birdie, it was not the show that I wanted to write, which taught me something about myself, which is I don't know where the hell I am half the time.
Let me ask you about writing the telephone hour from Bye Bye Birdie. And this is a series of phone conversations that the teenagers are having with each other. And it's not a straightforward song. I mean, you're basically setting a series of conversations to music with little interruptions and phones right. ringing. So what were some of your considerations when you were writing the music for that?
Well, you know, before I just answer that, I have four kids, and it's come back to haunt me because I have four telephone lines, and it's still every second everybody's on the phone. Anyway, beside the point, my considerations were, first of all, that it was rock, and of its sort, it is rock music, though such an innocent sort that, you know, I don't like to listen to it and say I'm Mick Jagger or anybody like that. But it was rock, and I paid attention very strongly to the guitar chords, you know, that all guitarists play on it. You know, a lot of rock music in those days particularly was very, I don't want to say simple because that wouldn't, that would be a little bit derogatory, but there were certain patterns. It became patterned in a way, and I did model it on that. But then I used a lot of... I used a lot of changes of time and a lot of interjections, which is into the exact rock beat. But I kept the beat going very much, and then I used Lee and I sat and kind of carved it out together, high and you know the things. Did they really get pinned?
Well, here's the telephone hour from Bye Bye Birdie, music by my guest Charles Strauss.
Hi, Margie.
Harvey Johnson, can I speak to Penelope Ann?
You know about Kim?
Penelope?
I just knew it somehow.
About the prom?
I must call her right up.
Saturday?
I can't talk to you now.
We'll hear more of our interview with composer Charles Strauss after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with composer Charles Strauss. You studied with Nadia Boulanger. Did she give you any advice about pop music versus classical music?
Well, oddly enough, she did. This woman was the great musician of our generation in many ways, and her greatness was that she was a master analyst, not only of music but a psychoanalyst in her own way. And she used to hear the music of her students, and she was able to isolate it. She was able to shine a spotlight on what was you, and what was watered down Stravinsky. I remember when when I worked with her, she asked to hear everything I'd written, and I played her my sonata and my concerto and various things, art songs and all that. And she said, well, what else? And I said, well, that's it. She said, well, no, what about, you know, your student pieces? And I played her some of them. And then she, anything else? And I said, well, I said, there was my parents, who were never into serious music at all, though they were very proud of me. I used to come home from college and play them all these pieces that sounded like watered down Bartok, really, but they were very serious kind of things. I was really, you know, into it. And I could see they were proud of me, but they didn't really
respond.
Yeah, not really. I mean, I think so. My mother was just always so nervous for me. But I remember writing a piece that I considered my party piece that I could play that they could show off to my aunt. I had an aunt, Stella, who she was hard of hearing to begin with, but it was she was over at the house a lot. And I wrote this piece, and it was really, you know, I look back at it today, kind of saucy or something. It was very lighthearted. And they loved, everybody liked it. So it became my piece. I played that for her, which I very rarely, I didn't do that for anybody except, you know, a couple of relatives. And she said, well, what else? And I said, well, when my brother, he had been in the Navy, and when he came home from his first tour of duty or his boot camp, whatever, I had written I laugh because it was a funny moment in my life. And I said, I wrote this little song for him called Welcome Home, Able-Bodied Seaman Strauss. See? And she said, may I hear that? Oh, I said, I could. No, she said, please. And so there, with this venerable woman, I played this silly song. She said, I see. She said, anything else? And I said, this makes me laugh. I said, I used to go out with a girl. I really liked her. Her name was Janet. And we lived on the Upper West Side of New York. And I wrote this song, but it was a joke called Moon Over 83rd Street. She said, play this for me. Here I am in Paris, you know, with an intimate of Stravinsky's and every American composer that you could think of having studied with this great woman. So I played Moon Over 83rd Street. And she said, good. Now we go back to this, whatever. So we went back to... towards the end of my thing, she said to me something that nobody had ever said to me. She said that you have a great talent for light music.
May I make a request?
Sure.
Could you sing one of the songs that you played for her?
Wait a second. The Welcome Home, Mabel Bunny Seaman Strauss. You're right. No, I can't sing that one. Moon Over It. Oh, Moon Over... This is the funniest interview I've ever done. Moon Over 83rd Street with shafts right below. Moon Over 83rd Street, my heart's all aglow. You, Janet, in the lamplight, I hear something call. I hear something dull. I'm yours, body and soul. I think that was the last one. It was meant partly as a jest. I mean, but that was it. There's a first performance for you.
So, but it helped you. It helped you find out that that's what you should be doing, is writing pop tunes.
That was her genius. That's why I can laugh at it. I can also laugh at it because I've had some successful shows. But her genius was really taking a young kid like me. I was quite young when I was there. I was around 18 or so, and I know from my own experience with my own children what it is to be searching for an identity. And she, in her soft, brilliant way, was able to contribute to my identifying who I was.
Charles Strauss, recorded in 1994. The New York Cabaret Rainbow and Stars is featuring a Charles Strauss review this month, starring Linda Lavin. Strauss's new musical, Palm Beach, is scheduled for Broadway next season. Strauss's hit Bye Bye Birdie was a comedy about an Elvis-type rock and roller named Conrad Birdie. The song Conrad Bertie sang that made the girl scream and faint was called Sincere. Of course, Sincere wasn't a real rock song. It was Strauss's version of a rock song. So I was quite entertained when rock singer-songwriter Marshall Crenshaw did his take on Sincere a couple of years ago on Fresh Air. Here it is.
Honestly Sincere, yeah. This is another thing. I used to play this at CBGB's back in the 80s, and people flipped, you know? I think people, you know, because it's like a... I was like making a TV reference because the movie's on TV all the time.
Uh-huh.
So people like TV references, I guess.
Can you do a little bit of it for us?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. Oh, yeah. You gotta be sincere. And then the girls scream.
Ah!
You gotta be sincere. You gotta feel it here. Because if you feel it here, then it's gonna be... what a... If... what you feel is true, you really feel it, you make them feel it too. Write this down now, you gotta be sincere, honestly sincere. I mean, you gotta be sincere. If you're really sincere, if you're really sincere, if you feel it in here, then it's gotta be right.
That's my cue, right?
Yeah, you did good.
Marshall Crenshaw recorded in 1994. Coming up, a review of the new film Fargo. This is Fresh Air. Joel and Ethan Coen set their new movie Fargo in their native Midwest. Brother Joel is the director. They wrote the screenplay together. Ever since their debut film, Blood Simple, in 1984, the Coen brothers have been admired for their cleverness, but often criticized for their cold-hearted self-indulgence. Film critic John Power says, with their new film, they've reined in their excessiveness and stripped down their style.
When most people think about Minnesota or North Dakota, they imagine snowy, flat states whose citizens are polite, sensible, and orderly. States that send Walter Mondale to the Senate or go big for Bob Dole in the Republican primary. But there's a loony underside to the American North, and that's the subject of a new movie by Joel and Ethan Coen. Called Fargo and based on a real-life crime, it's a ghoulishly funny thriller about hideous murder and the persistence of human decency. W.H. Macy plays Jerry Lundegaard, a car salesman from Minneapolis who's in desperate need of money. To scam a ransom from his father-in-law, he arranges for his wife to be snatched by two crooks. One of them a psycho, the other a smart aleck played by Steve Buscemi. But this kidnapping scheme goes terribly wrong, and soon all three are being pursued by Marge Gunderson, a hugely pregnant small-town cop whose puffy parka makes her look like a walking parade float. Something of a female Columbo, Marge is never more dangerous than when she seems most out to lunch. The Coens were raised in suburban Minnesota, and they take delight in sending up the great white bread north. There are countless gags about snow, Paul Bunyan, and local yokels. And the characters talk in a hyperbolic patois that's as flat and broad as the highway from St. Paul to Fargo. In fact, it's part of the movie's gallows humor that these funny accents exist side by side with appalling violence. As when Marge Gunderson first visits a murder scene on the highway near her hometown of Brainerd.
Here's the second one! It's in the head and the hand there. I guess that's a defensive wound.
Oh, yeah?
Where's the state trooper?
Back there, a good piece, in the ditch next to his prowler.
Okay. So we got a trooper pull someone over. We got a shooting. These folks drive by, there's a high-speed pursuit, ends here, and then this execution-type deal.
Yeah.
I'd be very surprised if our suspect was from Brainerd.
Yeah.
And I tell you what, from his footprint, he looks like a big fella.
Although dialogue like this had me laughing all the way through, a couple of friends from Minnesota insist that Fargo demeans its characters from beginning to end. And to be honest, they're not completely wrong. Ever since their debut with Blood Simple, the Coens have been high priests of snide, their comedy tinged with adolescent cruelty. They often turn violence into a joke and create characters whose stupidity the audience can look down on. But while Fargo is undeniably guilty of meanness, it still marks a breakthrough. In the past, the Coens have shied away from ordinary human emotions, as if it were embarrassingly unhip to invent characters who love their children, worry about losing their jobs, or find bloody murder objectionable. In Fargo, they finally seem to have pushed beyond this fear of feeling, at least in the scenes with Marge Gunderson, who's beautifully played by Frances McDormand. Although we're constantly giggling at her goofy manner, we realize that this enormous woman embodies genuine goodness. She does a difficult job efficiently and well. She loves her sweet-natured husband, Norm, a wildlife painter who dreams that his work will be put on a postage stamp. And like so many of us, she simply cannot understand why anyone would slaughter somebody just for money. It doesn't make any sense. Caught in the middle of a bloody farce, Marge affirms the value of human life, not least because she's carrying a child. In an irony that the Coens are too savvy not to appreciate, this murder story set in the frozen sprawl of Minnesota is the warmest movie they've ever made.
John Powers is the film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Nate Hardy is our intern. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.